Hi, Gerald Horn. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for inviting me.
Gerald Horn's a black Marxist historian credited by Cornel West as one of the great historians of our times. He uses a Marxist lens to illuminate the black experience internationally and especially in this country, illuminates the forces that operated to suppress and exploit blacks from their entry as slaves 400 years ago. His many books indicate his great scope. Let me mention just a few of them, over 30 books. The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in the 17th Century North America and Caribbean, Fire This Time, that's on Watts, Class Struggle in Hollywood, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, that is Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, and Paul Robeson, The Artist is Revolutionary, and that's just some of his books. Gerald Horn's a tireless and serious scholar and researcher. He teaches at the University of Houston. He practiced law while getting his history PhD. His almost latest book, it's for discussion today, Jazz and Justice, Racism, and the Political Economy of Music. Its footnotes stretch over 100 pages, but Jazz and Justice is no dry history. The lives of the people he explores, the incidents of their lives, his discussions of the forces they faced, his writing and Jazz and Justice. It's exciting, often surprising, a great introduction to the music and the artists and the ways of techniques of capitalists, big and small, to get away with murder. So, Gerald Horn, tell us about Jazz and Justice and why you wrote it, besides giving yourself a chance to listen to the music.
Well, first of all, I come from a musical family. My younger brother, Marvin Horn, is a well-known guitarist and musician. He's played all over the world. I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, which is an epicenter of this music. You might recall that Miles Davis, the celebrated trumpeter, was born and raised right across the river in Alton and East St. Louis. And there are numerous other musicians hailing from St. Louis, including the block on which I grew up on in St. Louis, where the Bowie brothers, Lester Bowie of the Art Ensemble of Chicago, and his younger brother Joe Bowie, who played with my brother in many bands from the time that they were peewees. So this is the environment that I grew up in, and I've also been trying to tell different stories, as your introduction suggested, of the black experience in North America, beginning with the early stages of slavery, stretching all the way up to the present. And as you suggested, doing this book allowed me to listen to a lot of music and to refresh my recollection about the music that helped to shape my consciousness early on.
You know, I read a good deal of it, not some other parts, but I did know boxing a little bit, and I was surprised by how much the music business resembled boxing, the complete exploitation of black talent. Tell us about the exploitation of black talent in the music business during the great jazz period.
Well, point number one is that I'm glad you mentioned boxing. I'm doing a book on boxing as we speak.
Oh,
point number two is that a number of leading musicians happen to be boxers, including Miles Davis, who you might recall worked out as a boxer quite a bit, and the drummer Stan Levy, who actually was a professional boxer. I think that some of the requirements for being a musician are fungible with regard to being transferred to boxing. That is to say, quick reflexes, supple fingers, to name a few, and certainly with regard to drumming, very adept and adroit footwork. With regard to the business, it might be useful to say that the traditional story is that this music that we call jazz, which is a music that presupposes the mastery of certain instruments, not least keyboards, strings, horns, etc., percussion, of course, has its roots in New Orleans, although part of that story is skewed by the fact that if you begin to look at the history of this music, which oftentimes involves adept improvisation, inevitably you're drawn to New Orleans, but I think that's because of the fact not only that a number of leading musicians hail from New Orleans, such as the premier trumpeter Louis Armstrong, right down to the present and the premier Marcellus, but also because a number of archivists at Tulane University in New Orleans, beginning in the 1950s, began to do interviews of older musicians, some of whom were born in the 1870s. And those oral histories point in the direction of New Orleans being the birthplace of this music. Perhaps if archivists and the librarians at the University of Memphis, which also challenges New Orleans as the birthplace of this music, had been as industrious as the archivists at Tulane, we'd be talking about Memphis as a birthplace, or even my hometown of St. Louis. If archivists at St. Louis University and Washington University and St. Louis had been more industrious, perhaps we'd be talking about St. Louis as a birthplace.
Could Chicago lay a claim to that title?
Its claim is not as firm as those of the cities along the Mississippi River.
Uh-huh.
But certainly, eventually, after this music takes off in the latter part of the 19th century, Chicago quickly gains a reputation as being a citadel of this music. Now, with regard to the business aspects, it's difficult to separate the origins or even perhaps the present of this music we call jazz from organized crime. That is to say, organized crime figures oftentimes ran the clubs where this music was being played. In New Orleans, as you know, a bordello oftentimes were a site for this music being played. And I'm afraid to say that organized crime figures were not necessarily equal employment opportunity champions, to put it mildly. On the other hand, as I talk about St. Louis in the 1920s, I point out that there is a battle royal taking place for control of this music between organized crime figures on the one hand, who wanted to exploit these mostly black musicians shamelessly, and Ku Klux Klan types who wanted to exclude them. There's an actual physical showdown between the two, with the former prevailing, and therefore the black musicians winning the dubious privilege of being exploited shamelessly as opposed to being excluded. There are a number of stories about musicians like Louis Armstrong, who I mentioned a moment or so ago, who in the 1930s went to Europe because he was fearful of his life because of the intrusion of organized crime into the business of running clubs. I also talk about how these musicians are exploited by those who you would think would not be so inclined. I mean, for example, the band leader and pianist and composer Duke Ellington, who some might regard as the premier musician in the history of the United States of America, his manager, Irving Mills, actually put his name, that is to say Mills' name, on some of Ellington's leading compositions, which means that today, 2020, that the descendants of the late Irving Mills are reaping the royalties of compositions penned by the late Duke Ellington. You should also know, and the book details this at some length, that club owners and record label owners were not adverse to trying to ply musicians with controlled substances, up to and including addictive drugs, assuming that this would make them more pliable and more subject to signing adhesion contracts, that is to say one-sided contracts, that would benefit capital as opposed to labor. And then there's the question of unions, which one thinks of as the ultimate protector of exploited labor. But with regard to these musicians, it was a bit more complicated than that, because oftentimes the Euro-Americans who control these unions saw these black musicians as unfair competition and therefore sought to keep them from being part of the union on the one hand. And then in the 1960s, when the walls of Jim Crow began to erode for reasons that need not detain us here, you saw that many of the so-called colored locals, the Negro locals of these musicians' unions, were swallowed whole by the larger so-called white locals. But this led to the destruction of records, the liquidation of real estate holdings of the so-called colored locals. And it also led to these larger so-called white-dominated locals then cutting deals with management and capital to the detriment of the black membership. So on the one hand, this story that I'm telling is a rather typical story of exploitation. But on the other hand, there's another story in this book about struggle and triumph over adverse conditions. It's a story of Charles Mingus and Max Roach seeking to seize part of the means of production by producing their own music and excluding the vampires and vultures that traditionally control this music. And it's a story of both triumph and tragedy.
This is Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole on cable radio, talking to Gerald Horn. He teaches history. He writes books, over 30. We've been talking about his book, Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music. So far, we've discussed how so many great, talented black musicians, many groups and sources and ways of insult and suppression and pacification and exploitation by the music moguls, big and small, and also apparently by the musicians' unions. I didn't know that story. And on the other side, they did fight back. You just suggested that. Let's get into that. You pointed out that, you know, the cities that take credit earlier in our interview. My sense is a lot of the great jazz musicians were people who their formative years were spent all over the country in one or another black ghettoized neighborhood and developed their music there, sometimes in the churches, and then they became really proficient and did interesting things, and they were attracted to going to these cities. It seems to me that music really comes out of localities and neighborhoods and people supporting one another and looking for ways of finding work and income that might be much better than just doing service work in hotels or, you know, hauling bricks.
Well, I would say that a major theme in this book we're discussing is the fact that from its inception, many of these musicians were working overseas. Not only in Western Europe, we all know about the sojourn of Charles Yardberg Parker of Kansas City, Kansas, in Europe, or Miles Dewey Davis in France, but also Tokyo. Art Blakey, the drummer, Ron Carter, the bassist, spending quite a bit of time in Tokyo. And also Dexter Gordon, the lanky saxophonist, spending time in Copenhagen. Or Art Farmer, spending time in Vienna. Ironically enough, many of these black musicians received a much fairer hearing and much better treatment overseas than in the land of their birth. And certainly, this sojourn overseas helped to keep this music alive, because there were also record companies overseas that pressed discs that could then be sold all over the world. It was a real lifeline for many of these musicians. I shudder to think what would have befallen these musicians if they had just been stuck in the wilderness of North America.
I'm really a Charlie Mingus fan, not that I know very much, but I love the music because it's so democratic, because everybody plays, and individual soloists then break out of the larger orchestra and get a minute or two or three of some really fine riff with all the other players cooperating in the background to highlight it. And everybody gets their chance, everybody speaks, and it's a conversation. Some pieces can be played very, very differently. It seems to me really just so wonderful to hear. I have the sense that the musicians who did jazz were very supportive of one another, helped one another out, joined with them, went into jam sessions and worked out all kinds of very complex kinds of conversations, musical conversations. You talked about the struggle by black musicians to form unions and to cooperate. Tell us about that.
Well, certainly this question of cooperation is essential to an understanding of this music. But once again, it's a checkered picture. I spent a good deal of time in this book talking about the travails of women musicians in particular, who oftentimes face discrimination on the bandstand, in the clubs, oftentimes being derided by critics who wonder why they might take up, for example, a bass fiddle as an instrument. So certainly there was cooperation in terms of building unions, in terms of working out complex musical equations. But at the same time, of course, just as you had discrimination against musicians of African ancestry, you had discrimination against women, particularly women of African ancestry. And this, too, I'm afraid to say, was a hallmark of this music we call jazz.
You know, you really are a scholar. I run on the cheerleader line sometimes about things that I don't know really well. I'm sure that weakened the movement quite a bit and weakened the whole body of, especially of black talent.
That is true.
One thing that we haven't discussed is the state and how the state operated with black musicians, especially those who were critical in any way. Why don't you tell the story of Eddie Palmieri?
Well, it's not just Eddie Palmieri and the difficulty he had as a musician of Puerto Rican ancestry and his running up against anti-communists, anti-Castro Cubans who were threatening his livelihood. It's also the fact that these musicians were confronting a state that was basically an apartheid state that imposed and implanted and enforced apartheid-type laws. I mean, Jim Crow was not just a matter of custom. It was a matter of state practice enforced through the law and through the courts and through legislatures. And it took a mighty international force, not to mention a mighty domestic movement, to finally erode the innards of this hateful, spiteful system. But this book talks about how musicians confronted the state, an apartheid state, which was determined to impose second-class citizenship upon them.
Gerald Horn, thanks so much for talking to us, and now you can get back to your book on boxing, which is number 34 or something. I'm sure it'll be as illuminating as the others. So thanks a lot.
Thank you for inviting me.
Right. So long.
Bye-bye.